and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 57, Germanicus. Surprise bonus Friday edition. I'm hopping on a plane tomorrow to visit the History of Roman laws, and since I just took a week off, I figured it would be pretty poor form to ditch out again, so here we are. The transition from Augustus to Tiberius went smoothly in Rome itself. The now utterly sycophantic Senate was quick to embrace their new emperor. But beyond the capital, out on the frontiers, the death of Augustus led to immediate unrest in a far more important body than the increasingly irrelevant Senate, the legions. It was not so much that the death of the princeps incited revolutionary spirits, so much as a few rabble-rousing common soldiers saw an opportunity to agitate for better conditions and make sure that certain promises made to them by Augustus were not ignored by Tiberius. The new emperor needed to secure the goodwill of the armies if he wanted to rule, right? So why not push him a little early in the game and threaten to crash his new regime into the ground if he didn't give them what they wanted? The mutinies of 14 AD would be a key early test of Tiberius's rule. Would he reveal himself to be nothing more than a cheap imitation of Augustus, or would he be able to rule in his own right? There were more than a few who did not believe that the imperial regime would be able to survive beyond Augustus, that the dead princeps possessed a singular quality that allowed him to rule unopposed. Once he was gone, the regime would collapse and the republic would be restored. But Tiberius proved to be stronger and much more capable than anyone had given him credit for, and the opposition to the regime proved thinner and weaker than most people had hoped. Tacitus notes that the transition was eased by the sheer length of Augustan rule. After 44 years in power, only the very old had a clear memory of what it was like to live before the Caesars took over. For the middle-aged and the young, it was perfectly natural to be ruled by a single man, whoever he turned out to be. Life was pretty good. The empire was prosperous, the civil wars were over. What was the big deal? There was still a Senate, it still had responsibilities, there were still consuls and proconsuls and aediles and tribunes. Everything was basically the same, except that in the end, the buck stopped somewhere in the imperial palace. And who wants that responsibility anyway? It would be years into the Tiberian regime before the Romans really got a taste of the dark side of absolute power. But by then, it was way too late. For his part, Tiberius tried to follow in the savvy footsteps of Augustus and make sure at first not to rub his power in anyone's face. He was deferential to the Senate almost to a fault, and when they tried to immediately heap upon him all the honors they had thrust upon Augustus, Tiberius demurred. Some he would accept, but some, like the civic crown or the title Father of the Country, he refused. He was interested in power, yes, but was perfectly willing to give the Senate a greater share in the governance of the country, if only to take some of the responsibility off of his plate. When they kept refusing to show some initiative, and instead kept waiting for him to tell them what to do, Tiberius complained that the Senate was full of men fit to be slaves. The once great body had descended into an impotent social club for rich old men. If Cato hadn't have been cremated, he would be spinning in his grave. But the legions were a different story. And they were not so quick to roll over for their new master. The first mutiny of 14 AD took place in Pannonia, where a few legions rose up against their officers and took control of the camps. The men then began looting the countryside for anything of value while they waited for some kind of reaction from Rome. When word came of the mutiny, Tiberius acted quickly and ordered his son Drusus to go take control of the situation. He didn't want to go himself, as it would set a bad precedent that all it took to get the new emperor to come around was a little insubordination. Tiberius wanted the men to understand that it was beneath his dignity to personally address such trivial issues like insubordinate foot soldiers. But he also wanted to signal that he took the mutiny seriously and that he was not simply going to blow off the demands from his army, which was, after all, critical to his remaining in power. So he split the difference and sent Drusus. Accompanying the emperor's son were two cohorts of Praetorian Guard, led by a man who was to act as Drusus' advisor on the trip, and who will play a major role in our next episode, Lucius Sejanus. When Drusus arrived, the men were in a sorry state of disrepair, and while they accepted Drusus into camp, they were not thrilled to see him rather than his father. Drusus promised to do his best to meet the soldiers' demands, mostly centered around reducing the service time from 20 years down to 16, but that he would also have to consult with Tiberius before any final decisions could be made. The leaders of the mutiny accused Drusus of playing the same good cop, bad cop routine with them that Tiberius and Augustus used to play, with Tiberius now playing the bad rather than the good cop. Drusus swore this wasn't the case, but the incensed troops drove him from the dais anyway. That night, though, Drusus sent allies into the camps to speak one-on-one with the soldiers. What did they think the final outcome of all this was going to be? That somehow the leaders of the mutiny were going to be made generals and put in line for the throne? That attacking the son of the emperor was going to make Tiberius more likely to give in to their demands? By morning, Tiberius had sowed enough doubt with the men that they were ready to let go their treason. He promised the soldiers unconditional pardons and the right to present their case to Tiberius if they returned control of the camps to their officers and produced the leaders of the mutiny for trial. The soldiers, having thought through the likely penalty for keeping up the revolt, immediately complied. The first test of Tiberius's reign ended in success for the new emperor, thanks to the savvy diplomacy of his son. But immediately after the situation in Pannonia was settled, a similar mutiny broke out on the banks of the Lower Rhine. A few of the legions stationed there revolted against their officers and drove them out of the camp, following the lead of their brothers down in Pannonia. This time, it was Germanicus who hastened to the crisis. Germanicus was the biological grandnephew of Augustus and the biological nephew of Tiberius, and by legal adoption was now the grandson of the old emperor and the son of the new one. He had just arrived in Gaul to take on the command assigned to him by the Senate after the passing of Augustus when news of the revolt came, and he quickly made his way to the mutinous camps. Germanicus took after his father, Tiberius's brother Drusus. He was popular, easygoing, a natural leader, and an accomplished soldier, an all-around Roman dreamboat. If you ladies out there want to get a look at the young hunk, there's a picture of a sculpture of Germanicus posted along with this week's episode, taken by the History of Rome's Belgian correspondent Justin, who recently took a visit to the British Museum and was kind enough to send along an album's worth of pictures, which I'm sure you'll see pop up now and again as we move forward. I also want to mention that back on the Teutoburg Forest episode, there are now some pictures posted of a reenactment of the battle, taken a few years ago by chief reenactment correspondent Carolyn, who was good enough to send them along. Awesome stuff, so go check it out. Being as popular as he was with the men, at first the troops tried to convince Germanicus to join them, that if he wanted to seize the throne from Tiberius, they would be more than happy to help him. But Germanicus was indignant at the very suggestion, and promised to kill himself before joining in their treason. Chastened, the men simply ticked off their grievances, which again centered around earlier retirement and more pay for the soldiers who still owed service time. Germanicus, unlike Drusus, went ahead and granted their request unilaterally, rather than waiting for final word from Tiberius. He left the camps pacified and thought that that was the end of it, but the troops soon learned that a delegation from the Senate was on the way. Fearing that the delegation would cancel the promises of Germanicus, the troops again mutinied, and when the senatorial party arrived, the delegates were attacked. Germanicus hurried back to the scene and shamed the men for shooting first and asking questions later. How did they know what the plans of the delegation were? The men from Rome hadn't even been given a chance to speak. Having talked them down from the ledge once again, Germanicus decided it was best to immediately follow through on the promise of dismissal for those who had served more than 16 years. He paid them what discharge bonuses he could out of his own pocket and sent them to Raetia for settlement. Usually, discharged soldiers settle in the provinces where they served, but Germanicus wanted to make sure that these particular disgruntled troops were put out of everyone's sight and out of everyone's mind. He also went through the ranks of the men one by one with their officers and expelled identified troublemakers from the army. With the men once again pacified, Germanicus began to make plans for a long-term solution to the unrest. The problem, he decided, was inactivity. When soldiers aren't fighting, the officers have to come up with some way to keep them occupied, and that usually amounted to day after day of dull, manual labor. Bored and disgruntled soldiers become mutinous soldiers very quickly. Germanicus resolved to give the legions on the Rhine something to do. Back in Rome, Tiberius did not like the reports he was getting from the region. The men were trying to declare Germanicus imperator, and he was doling out concessions that had not been approved by Rome. Even with the blatantly obvious demonstration of Germanicus's loyalty to Tiberius a matter of public record, Tiberius went to bed at night with visions of a Germanicus-led coup dancing in his head. I guess it was simply the fact that so many would be willing to follow the young general if he decided to do something that kept him up at night. But despite his misgivings, Tiberius decided to allow Germanicus to remain on the Rhine. Who knows, maybe he would fall off his horse and die like his father Drusus before him. That would be nice. He wouldn't, though. Instead, Germanicus would just raise his profile even more, much to Tiberius's chagrin. In 15 AD, a year which saw Tiberius's son Drusus taking over the consulship, and fatefully, Lucius Sejanus taking over as Praetorian prefect, Germanicus decided to do something about the inactivity of the legions on the Rhine. Their boredom had led to mutiny, so Germanicus decided to stimulate them. When the spring came, he ordered his men across the river on a raiding expedition. One of the things that had triggered the previous year's mutiny was the perception that they would be denied bonuses promised to them by Augustus now that the old princeps was dead. So Germanicus told them that any plunder taken during that season's campaign would be their bonuses. There wasn't much in the way of long-term strategic aims when it came to Germanicus's expeditions across the Rhine. The point was for the Romans to continue revenging themselves on the Germans for the massacre in the Teutoburg Forest, while seizing as much treasure and as many slaves as they could. Not exactly the most high-minded of aims, but Germanicus would still emerge from the invasion more famous and more loved in Rome than ever. One of the keys to his lasting fame was the fact that the young general seemed to put the horror of the Teutoburg behind Rome forever, just as Scipio had once put Cannae behind them by finally defeating Hannibal. In fact, when it came to Germanicus, comparisons to Scipio and even Alexander the Great came early and often. Germanicus did not conclusively defeat the Germans, but he did demonstrate that the disaster in the Teutoburg Forest was an aberration. Whenever you get beaten like that, you can't help but wonder if it's the beginning of the end, if all the good times are in the past, and that now maybe you can't keep up anymore. The Romans had to wonder if they were still the invincible force they told themselves they were, or whether those days were now in the rearview mirror. They had, after all, spent the last few years only fighting each other, not really thinking about what was going on in the greater world. But Germanicus's incursions into Germany, while not universally successful, nonetheless showed that Rome could still hold its own on the battlefield against foreign enemies. And as much as that one battle came to define the Roman abandonment of Germania, more precisely, it was Tiberius deciding to shutter Germanicus's campaigns that really sealed the deal. And even that was much more about personal rivalry than it was about policy. At the time, Germania was politically divided into coastal tribes who were friendly to Rome, the powerful tribes in Bohemia who remained neutral, and the fiercely anti-Roman confederation forged by Arminius in the central part of the country. Germanicus crossed into Germania in the spring of 15 with upwards of 100,000 men and made straight for Arminius. Revenge was on everyone's mind. Germanicus was able to easily cut through the defense forces sent to stop him, and at one point even captured Arminius's wife. But the chief himself and the bulk of the German army remained elusive. Germanicus followed this with a key victory on the Ems River, but no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't bend Arminius and the Germans down. When battles started to go against them, they simply disappeared into the forest, living to fight another day. By avoiding defeat, Arminius was able to rally more tribes to drive off the invaders, and the campaign began to look more evenly matched, with the Germans now offering much stiffer resistance. Before the year was out, though, Germanicus was able to accomplish at least one of the goals he had set for himself. Following the lead of survivors from the battle, Germanicus's army made their way to the site of the Teutoburg massacre. What they found was the chilling leftover of a slaughter. Bones and debris still lay strewn and unburied. Heads had been chopped off and nailed to trees. The evidence of the religious sacrifices the Germans had turned captured officers into also remained, and the survivors who were present attested to the roasting alive of prisoners. Germanicus ordered the remains buried and a funeral mound built to honor the dead. This solemn duty performed, Germanicus pointed his army once again toward Arminius and attacked. But the German leader was able to lure his Roman foes into a trap. He led them into a swampy area and left the Romans with nothing but a thin strip of dry land to work with. But despite the terrible terrain, the legions were able to fortify a defensive position. Against his better judgment, Arminius decided to follow the advice of his more aggressive uncle and ordered an assault on the Roman position. Though the Romans would always struggle against the elements in Germania, When they were behind a wall and dealing with a frontal assault, well, they had been there before. So instead of annihilating a second Roman army, and probably making himself as famous as Hannibal to boot, Arminius was forced to retreat after suffering massive casualties. Germanicus led his men out of the swamp and back across the Rhine for the winter. The next year saw Germanicus only more determined than ever to crush Arminius. The Romans tracked the German leader to the Weser River. An initial battle erupted when the Romans attempted to cross. Arminius swooped in and tried to prevent the crossing, but his men were unable to hold the Roman tide back, though heavy casualties did force Germanicus to withdraw further up the river once he was on the far side. The Germans pursued, and a second battle broke out. In this encounter, Arminius was injured, but he managed to escape uncaptured. The final confrontation took place further downstream, past the site of the original crossing. Just as has occurred at the end of the last year, the Romans were able to inflict serious damage on the German army, but when things got bad enough, Arminius simply ordered his men to melt back into the forest. Germanicus had to leave it there for the year. The weather was turning, and he had to get his men back to the safety of Gaul. The return trip, though, proved to be almost as dangerous as facing the Germans. Germanicus decided that the quickest route would be to ferry his men downriver and sail around to Gaul by way of the North Sea, preferring it to slogging through the marshland back to Gaul. But a storm kicked up as the fleet hit the open water and drove them against the rocks. But rather than this debacle tarnishing his image, the incident actually served to boost Germanicus's popularity even more, as stories of the young general risking his life to drag survivors of the shipwrecks ashore filtered down to Rome. Tiberius, settling into his first years as emperor, watched all of this with a combination of anger and fear. He had had every intention of keeping Rome permanently on the west bank of the Rhine, and here was Germanicus flagrantly invading Germania season after season. But not only did the young man's incursions rub Tiberius the wrong way policy-wise, it also rubbed him the wrong way personally. Never socially at ease or a particularly popular man, Tiberius chafed as the people cheered for Germanicus. It wouldn't do to simply cancel the invasions because, after all, Germanicus's victories ultimately reflected well on the imperial regime. But if this went on much longer, would the people call for the dour Tiberius to be replaced by the bright and chipper Germanicus? The troops along the Rhine had already tried it once, after all. Always slightly paranoid and carrying a mighty chip on his shoulder, Tiberius didn't like where any of this was headed. So he decided to use the occasion of Germanicus' success on the far side of the Rhine to promote his adopted son. Hopefully, promote him high enough that he could be kept out of trouble, be watched, and perhaps disposed of. So Germanicus was recalled to Rome. When he entered the city, Tiberius awarded him the first triumph the city had seen in almost 40 years. Augustus had basically done away with the practice. Displayed along with his other spoils were two prizes that caused the people to shower even more love on Germanicus. Two of the three legionary standards lost by Varus had been found and retaken during the previous year's campaigns. But once his day in the sun came to an end, Germanicus was dismayed to learn that he would not be headed back to the Rhine. Instead, Tiberius told him, he would be given at-large proconsular authority over the eastern provinces. After all, Germanicus was destined to succeed him. It wouldn't do to have him risking his life fighting savages. No, it was time to grow more acquainted with the routine of empire. It wasn't as glamorous, but it was more important. Reluctantly, Germanicus accepted the promotion and packed his wife Agrippina and their children, including young Gaius, the future infamous Emperor Caligula, and their daughter Agrippina the Younger, who would one day be the wife of Claudius and the mother of Nero. But Tiberius had no intention of letting Germanicus have his way with things in the East. The point of the promotion was to marginalize Germanicus, not, you know, actually promote him. So Tiberius appointed a close confidant named Gnaeus Calpurnius Piso to the governorship of Syria. Well, all we have to go on is supposition and accusations. The word on the street is that Piso, at a minimum, was appointed specifically to stymie any initiatives embarked upon by Germanicus. And at a maximum, Piso was said to have engineered, at Tiberius's order, the young heir apparent's death. From 17 to 19 AD, Germanicus lived and worked in the East, settling local disputes, doling out justice, and doing some good old-fashioned sightseeing, including taking in the ruins of Troy. Along the way, he clashed time and again with Piso, who seemed determined to undermine him at every turn, almost as if that was the whole reason he had been appointed governor. Germanicus would order Piso to send troops to Armenia, and Piso would refuse. He would make staff appointments in the army and find them canceled by Piso. After his fateful trip to Egypt, which I'll get to in a second, Germanicus returned to Antioch and discovered that Piso had been busy undoing every decision he had ever made about provincial administration. There was no love lost between the two, and any time they were in the same room, the air was chilly and the threats were veiled. Until the trip to Egypt, though, there was no indication that Piso, or Tiberius, had anything more sinister in mind than making Germanicus's life miserable. But when word got back to Tiberius that Germanicus was in Egypt, the emperor's attitude seems to have taken a murderous turn. The thing about Egypt was that it was probably the most important province in the whole empire. Its wealth bankrolled the imperial regime, and its ample grain supplies fed the people of Rome. From the moment he seized the country from Antony and Cleopatra, Augustus knew that Egypt was the key to the whole game. As long as the province was administered personally by the emperor, no ambitious rival could touch the regime. So Augustus had declared Egypt to be the personal property of the emperor. Any Roman of rank who wished to enter the territory had to receive the express written consent of the emperor before doing so. But Germanicus had ignored this protocol and simply headed on down. Offended and threatened by his nephew/son's action, Tiberius likely got word to Piso that enough was enough. In 19 AD, shortly after returning to Antioch, Germanicus fell ill. Because of the previous run-ins with Piso, poison was immediately suspected. There was certainly no doubt in the mind of Germanicus and Agrippina that he was being poisoned anyway. Reports also come down to us of strange objects being discovered in the family's house. Human remains, tablets with Germanicus's name crossed out, piles of ash. All of it led the family to believe that some sort of black magic was at play as well. Despite his lifetime record of good health, Germanicus just kept getting worse. Finally, after telling Agrippina for her sake and the children's not to risk pursuing justice and to beware of Tiberius, Germanicus died. He was only 34 years old. His body was cremated in Antioch, and Agrippina bore his ashes back to Rome, where the entire country went into mourning. Never heeding her dead husband's advice, Agrippina made no secret that she thought Piso was behind her husband's death, or that she thought Tiberius was behind Piso. Whether or not Tiberius really ordered Piso to assassinate Germanicus, the charges were now out there in the open, and the emperor had to do something about it. Tiberius, of course, denied all involvement, and when Agrippina and Germanicus's old friends formally requested that charges be brought against Piso, the emperor had no choice but to grant the request. If he wasn't involved, he had no reason to stand in the way of justice, even if he himself argued that the charges against Piso were preposterous. Returning to Rome, the ex-governor of Syria faced the Senate, defiant and refusing to accept blame for what he termed nothing more than a sad twist of fate. The Senate, though, was ill-disposed toward Piso and heard more than enough testimony to convince them that something fishy had gone on. When Tiberius refused to use his imperial prerogative to get Piso off the hook, the accused committed suicide. Either that, or he was killed by Tiberius because the emperor was afraid that a cornered Piso might just spill his guts. Whatever Tiberius's actual role in the death of Germanicus, Agrippina's version of events was widely believed thereafter. The emperor had murdered his adopted son because he was jealous of the young man and was afraid of his growing power. This would be the beginning of a chasm that would open up between the people of Rome and their emperor. They came to hate him, and in time, he came to hate them too. For a while, Tiberius remained fully engaged in imperial administration and was a mostly effective ruler, despite his poor standing with the people. Next week, though, Tiberius will go off the deep end and wind up abandoning Rome completely, literally leaving Rome forever, never to return. Hated by the people, smothered by his mother, and grieving the sudden death of his son Drusus, Tiberius will withdraw from public life and leave the day-to-day operation of Rome to his trusty lieutenant Sejanus. An ironic choice, as it was Sejanus who had murdered Drusus in the first place. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 58, Partner of My Labors. Last week, we followed the aborted career of Germanicus, who died under mysterious circumstances in 19 AD. Whether the charges were true or not, Tiberius was widely believed to have played a role in the death of the popular young prince, and the emperor's popularity with the people suffered as a result. Never personable to begin with, Tiberius did not enjoy the kind of respect Augustus had garnered so naturally. With the death of Germanicus, the distance between the emperor and his people only widened. But even still, through these early years, Tiberius was a prudent and dedicated ruler. He had taken to heart Augustus's injunction not to embroil the empire in foreign wars, and did his best to resolve border disputes peacefully without resorting to the kind of military adventurism that Germanicus pursued with such zeal. The money saved by not having to keep up active campaigns on numerous fronts was spent elsewhere, improving the infrastructure of the empire and the efficiency of its governing apparatus. But that does not mean that Tiberius enjoyed his work. If you believe some sources, Tiberius never wanted to become emperor to begin with, and had been pushed into becoming princeps by his mother, Livia, who was living her ambition through her son. If, on the other hand, he actually did seek to become emperor, then it's clear he quickly became disenchanted with the prize he had sought. I personally get the feeling that Tiberius would have been content to simply command a few legions by day and read Greek literature in his tent by night. But despite his own personal unhappiness, a sense of honor and duty seems to have kept Tiberius functioning as a thoughtful ruler for a few years, even after the people really turned on him following the death/assassination of Germanicus. But the underlying misery of Tiberius would eventually overtake him and turn him into the paranoid, debauched, and cruel emperor we all know and love today. Tiberius was only able to hold off his demons for so long, and after the death of his son Drusus in 23 AD, which we'll get to in a moment, Tiberius seems to have allowed them free rein over his psyche. Stoking the gloomy fires in Tiberius's heart was a man of great personal ambition who saw Tiberius's growing paranoia as an opportunity for advancement, the prefect of the Praetorian Guard, Lucius Sejanus. Before we get too far into the drama of the 20 ADs, though, we should probably take a moment to understand what the Praetorian Guard was at this point, and how Sejanus was able to leverage his role as their captain into a position of power that for a few years probably exceeded that of Tiberius himself. I mentioned the Praetorians thus far only in passing, but as they will play a key role in practically every important episode for the next few centuries, they are worth taking the time to understand. The Guard had existed in various incarnations going back to the 200s BC, and was generally understood to be little more than an elite cohort of soldiers who served as bodyguards for a general. The name Praetorian is derived from the Latin word Praetorium, which was the name for the general's tent within a legionary camp around which these elite soldiers would be stationed. During the civil wars, the major figures involved all had cohorts of Praetorian guards serving them, but it wasn't until Octavian emerged triumphant that a single, quote, Praetorian guard emerged as a formal institution within the state. During the reign of Augustus, the guard were stationed in and around Rome and were used as a combination police force, intelligence service, and, of course, bodyguard for the imperial family. Augustus set their number at 9 cohorts of 500 men each, which he later upped to 1,000. But, conscious of appearances, he did not station them at a central base within Rome. Instead, he scattered the men in lodgings throughout Italy. Augustus wanted their presence known and felt, but not so much so that it put lie to his claims of republican legitimacy. So at any given time, only 3 cohorts would be on active duty in the capital itself. During the Augustan period, the Praetorian was a fairly benign force. But once Augustus was dead, the guard seems to have grown aware of the power it could easily possess if it simply pushed a little. Tiberius really gave them a glimpse of the apple when he decided to eschew Augustus's policy of keeping the troops scattered and instead lodge them in a single barrack just outside of Rome. At the same time, he upped their ranks by 3 more cohorts, bringing their total to some 12,000 men. Tiberius also let slip the policy of keeping 2 prefects at all times in charge of the guard, mimicking the pattern of the consulship, which had for so long prevented power from accumulating in the hands of one man. The first man to serve as sole prefect, the aforementioned Sejanus, had a ruthless Machiavellian personality, and from this point on, the Praetorian became a political force as well as a military one. Ostensibly, the guard relied upon the emperor for their status, and as such, should remain perfectly loyal to him. But in practice, Tiberius and all of his successors found that it was far more the other way around. The emperor relied upon the praetorian for his position. As such, the guard began to wield something of a de facto veto over state affairs. Because what was the emperor going to do? Cross them? They guarded the imperial family while they slept. For the next few hundred years, the Praetorian Guard would sit fat and comfortable in roomy barracks with their double pay and lax discipline and dare anyone to challenge them. Anytime they took a dislike to a sitting emperor, they would simply assassinate or depose him and elevate a man they thought would treat them better. They went so far at one point as to actually auction off the job of emperor to the highest bidder after murdering the previous occupant of the office. This model of using the monopoly they held on the use of force within Rome to maintain their own status and push their own agenda was invented by Lucius Sejanus, a man who, at his height, was arguably the most powerful man in the empire. Sejanus was born into the equestrian class, the socioeconomic level just beneath that of the senatorial class. His family was connected to the regime by his grandfather's marriage to Maecenas' sister, but they were by no means in the upper echelon of Roman society. Sejanus' father caught the eye of Augustus while the former was still a young man, and he was brought into the Praetorian Guard and eventually made one of its two prefects. After Augustus died, young Sejanus was appointed to serve as his father's colleague, but critically, when the elder man was appointed to serve as governor of Egypt, an appointment which speaks volumes about the trust Tiberius had in this particular family, Sejanus was left as the sole prefect, and Tiberius appointed no colleague to serve with him. It seems that right away, Sejanus was a slave to ambition and immediately set his sights on elevating himself above the ceiling placed on him by his equestrian status. And for years, Tiberius was content to allow Sejanus's ambition to flourish. Now, what exactly Sejanus was ultimately aiming for has been a topic of great debate over the years. Numerous ancient sources claim that he had his sights set squarely on making himself emperor, but the modern consensus is that he was looking to be named regent for one of Tiberius's young heirs once Tiberius himself was dead. But of course, when Sejanus began to scheme after attaining sole control of the Praetorian Guard in 15 AD, there was one giant obstacle in his way, Tiberius's son Drusus. With Drusus the obvious heir to the throne, there was no room for Sejanus at the top, as young Drusus was not young enough to require an overbearing regent to rule in his name. Now you might be saying, okay, well, we're about to see that Sejanus was able to do a pretty good job worming his way into Tiberius's favor. Why not just keep on keeping on and be the power behind the throne of the eventual emperor Drusus as well? The answer is that Drusus hated Sejanus. He found the manipulative prefect absolutely despicable, and Sejanus in turn hated Drusus, even more so after the hot-tempered heir had actually hit him during one of their frequent arguments. If Drusus did become emperor, Sejanus would probably be lucky if he was simply removed from office. Exile would not be out of the question, nor would forced suicide, nor execution. I think it's safe to say that nothing would have been more disastrous to the life and career of Lucius Sejanus than the ascension of Emperor Drusus. While he was wondering how to get around Drusus, Sejanus was also thinking about how to get around the fact that he was merely an equestrian and had likely risen as high as his status would ever permit. Finally, the prefect hit upon an answer that would take care of both of his problems simultaneously, an elegant, if sinister, little solution. At the time, Drusus was married to Livilla, the daughter of Tiberius's brother Drusus, and Antonia, the daughter of Octavia and Mark Antony. If Drusus were to suddenly die, and the widowed Livilla was allowed to marry Sejanus, then he would become a member of the imperial family, and any children he sired would themselves become potential heirs to the throne. So he set about seducing Livilla, in the hopes that she would not only welcome him as her husband, but also that she might help him eliminate Drusus. Luckily for Sejanus, Livilla was more than open to cheating on her persistently absentee husband. Once the affair got going, it did not take much for Sejanus to convince Livilla that Drusus was a hindrance to them both. If Drusus were eliminated, Sejanus would whisper in her ear, then they could be together in the open. Sejanus would be in a much more powerful position politically, and together they might eventually rule the empire. Clearly, Livilla had no great love for Drusus, because in 23 AD, she agreed to secretly administer poison to her unsuspecting husband. Apparently, she and Sejanus did such a good job that no one ever suspected that Drusus' sudden illness and death was the result of foul play. It would be years before the truth came out. Tacitus marks the death of Drusus as the turning point in Tiberius' reign. The emperor had shared a consulship with his son in 21 AD and was in the process of transferring a great deal of administrative authority to Drusus at the time of the young man's death. Tiberius had failed to get the Senate to help him with his increasingly unwelcome burdens of office, and had ever since viewed Drusus as the answer to his unhappiness. When Drusus died, Tiberius suffered the blow not just as a father who had lost a son, but also as a prisoner who had been denied parole. Now, a faction of ancient historians, led by Suetonius, report that Tiberius cared very little for his son and actually cut short the customary mourning period and returned to work because he had nothing really to mourn at all. But I am more convinced by Tacitus that the death was a personal and professional disaster for Tiberius, given everything else we know about the emperor and the fact that Suetonius, wonderful writer that he is, tends to traffic in unflattering gossip. The murder of Drusus was a crime that remained hidden for close to a decade, and for that stretch, things went almost completely according to plan for Sejanus. Tiberius, who was still looking for someone to help him govern, turned to his willing prefect for support and found Sejanus' administrative skills and general cunning to be a valuable resource. The emperor began to rely on him more and more to actually run the empire. With Tiberius trusting in him completely, Sejanus acted as a sort of super executive assistant who controlled the flow of information into and out of the imperial quarters. Tiberius only saw collars approved by Sejanus, only read letters approved by Sejanus, and only issued orders approved by Sejanus. The prefect became so influential that Tiberius called him nothing less than the partner of my labors. But Sejanus's plan was only half fulfilled. He was now one of the most powerful men in the empire and no longer had to worry about the wrath of a potential emperor Drusus. But his attempt to marry into the imperial family was blocked by the emperor. After waiting a suitable amount of time following the death of Drusus, Sejanus asked Tiberius for the widow Livilla's hand in marriage in 25 AD. However, unlike just about every other decision the emperor made, he refused to consider the matter. As important as Sejanus was, he was still, after all, merely an equestrian. When a daughter of the imperial family married, it had better be to a man of at least senatorial rank. Anything less would be beneath her. Come now, Sejanus, be serious. What would the neighbors think? Afraid that pressing the issue would cause him to lose favor, Sejanus was forced to swallow his pride and drop the matter. Not forever, just for now. With his plan to enter the Julio-Claudian dynasty temporarily thwarted, Sejanus turned all of his attention to accumulating as much power for himself as possible. To this end, he decided to lean hard on Tiberius's natural paranoia and drive a physical as well as psychological wedge between Tiberius and the people of Rome. Ever since the death of Germanicus, Agrippina and her allies in the Julian wing of the Julio-Claudian dynasty made no secret of the fact that they blamed Tiberius for Germanicus' death. Sejanus decided to play up the threat they might pose to Tiberius and began trumping up treason charges against various high-ranking officials allied with Agrippina. It was all political theater, of course, acted out for an audience of one. Already inclined to believe that everyone was out to get him, when Sejanus began showing him evidence that they really were all out to get him, Tiberius withdrew even further from the public realm. He began holing up in Campania on extended vacations that kept him out of Rome for longer and longer periods of time with each passing year. Pretty soon, living in the bubble created by Sejanus, Rome began to loom in Tiberius' imagination as a mortally dangerous city packed with treacherous vipers and hostile mobs. In 26 AD, he decided to retreat to his villa on the island of Capri and leave Rome to its own devices. No one knew it at the time, but when he left the city that year, it would be the last time Tiberius would actually set foot in Rome. He would constantly send word that he was coming back soon, that he would be there any day, but excuses always delayed travel, and he just never got around to it. The truth is that Tiberius was probably terrified of returning to the city, convinced as he was that as soon as he did, the mobs would riot and tear him limb from limb. For the last 11 years of his reign, Tiberius ruled in absentia from Capri. His man on the ground, of course, was Sejanus, who promised to look after Tiberius's interests in Rome until it was safe for the emperor to return. Now, there is a loose variable in all of this that I have thus far neglected to mention, who kept Sejanus's power from becoming complete at this point, and who also may have played a part in Tiberius's second and final self-imposed exile, his mother Livia, now known as the Augusta. During the early years of Tiberius's reign, there seems to have been a cordial, if distant, relationship between mother and son. She did not lack for valuable advice, and there is no denying that she was a fierce advocate for her son's interests. But she also exuded a sort of omnipresence that began to wear on Tiberius. There was no end to the snide gossip that Tiberius had been placed on the throne by his mother, and it was she who really pulled the strings of power. Tiberius struggled to become his own man, and tried to only consult with his mother when absolutely necessary. He wanted to demonstrate that he ruled in his own right, but the Augusta had her own base of support, and there would always be those who saw Tiberius as a necessary figurehead in patriarchal Rome, and that in fact the empire was actually being ruled by its first empress. Though he gave as much latitude to his mother as he felt he could, there were times when the two butted heads publicly. Sometimes she got her way and sometimes he got his way, but Tiberius seemed unable to escape the perception that when he got his way, it was because the Augusta had relented to a petulant child, and when she got her way, it was because, well, she was the real power in Rome. Tiberius just could not win. And of course, the Augusta did little to disabuse anyone of the notion that all of it wasn't true. Almost all the ancient sources agree that when Tiberius withdrew from Rome in 26 AD, it was at least in part to get away from his overbearing mother. The depth of the enmity toward her that had grown in Tiberius by the end is amply demonstrated by the fact that when she finally died in 29 AD, he claimed that he was too busy with work to return to Rome for her funeral. But as I've said, the Augusta was a fierce advocate for her son, whether it was in pursuit of her own interests or not. When it came to Tiberius, she was always on the watch for potential dangers to his regime. Thus, when Sejanus wormed his way into the emperor's confidence and began his de facto rule of Rome when Tiberius retired to Capri, he was prevented from wielding absolute control over the empire because the Augusta had her own direct lines of communication to her son that Sejanus was unable to block. The prefect was smart enough not to cross the Augusta, so though he was poised to completely dominate the empire, he wasn't quite there yet. Eventually, Sejanus planned to eliminate anyone who threatened his rise, but a good number of those threats sat in the Augusta's sphere of influence. It would be monumentally stupid to stir up that hornet's nest when he didn't have to. He had plans, lots of plans, but as long as the Augusta was alive, he would have to sit on them. So when, in 29, the Augusta finally passed away, Sejanus put on a public face of mourning, but inside was ecstatic. He could now, finally, make his move. One of those main centers of opposition to him that Sejanus wanted to quickly destroy had grown up around Agrippina. Luckily, eliminating her would not ruffle any imperial feathers, as Tiberius himself hated her and wanted her out of the picture. Not only was she still beating the "Tiberius killed my husband" drum, but she also actively promoted her own sons as the true heirs to the imperial throne. Augustus had wanted Germanicus to follow Tiberius, she said, so it was only logical that Germanicus's sons stand as the rightful heirs. It was Augustus's will that the Julians return to power and not allow Rome to be ruled by, gag me with a spoon, a succession of Claudians, or that snake in the grass, Sejanus. Acting nothing like the good little Roman woman, Agrippina very publicly inserted herself into politics and gathered around her family something of an opposition party to the standing regime. Her distrust of the emperor was so great that at a dinner party one night, he offered her some fruit, and she refused to eat it, convinced that he was trying to poison her. Tiberius himself claimed that the entire scene was prearranged to test her loyalty, a test that she failed spectacularly. Agrippina, unwilling as ever to back down, told her supporters that Tiberius had in fact tried to poison her, and then concocted the story of a loyalty test after the fact, once she escaped his murderous clutches. When the Augusta died, Sejanus went straight away after Agrippina on the explicit order of Tiberius. Whether the idea of trying Germanicus's family for treason was originally planted in the emperor's head by Sejanus or not, there is no doubt that Tiberius fully supported their persecution. Agrippina and her two eldest sons, Nero Caesar and Drusus Caesar, were tried and convicted on trumped-up charges of attempting to overthrow the regime. The fates of all three were gruesome. The elder son, Nero Caesar, was murdered shortly after the trial, while his brother was left to rot in prison for 4 years before being intentionally starved to death in 33 AD. It is reported that by the end, he was reduced to eating the stuffing from his bedding in a vain attempt to survive. Agrippina herself was exiled to a desolate island, and after enduring years of beatings, she too died in 33 AD, broken and malnourished. The only one of Germanicus's sons to survive was young Gaius, known to all by the nickname Caligula, who was too young to be considered a threat. I wonder if this thoroughly traumatized boy, who just watched his mother and brothers be murdered by his adoptive grandfather, is going to grow up to be a sociopathic monster. Stay tuned, we'll all find out together. But the persecution of Germanicus's family was only the beginning. Rome under Tiberius was already suffering from far more restrictions on individual liberty than it had under the confident and permissive Augustus. Throughout the 20s, Tiberius had begun to elevate every real or perceived slight against the regime to the level of capital T treason. Now, with Sejanus in total control of Tiberius, the cruel paranoia of the aging emperor was given free rein. Where once maybe a few men a year were tried and convicted of treason, now it became a daily event. Treason trials ran continuously, and a bloody purge not seen since the days of the Second Triumvirate overtook the city. With Sejanus overseeing the proceedings, it became clear early that those charged with treason were overwhelmingly personal enemies of the Praetorian Prefect. Under the guise of protecting Tiberius, Sejanus was actually killing off his opponents and putting everyone else on notice that they had better not cross him. But in 31 AD, just as Sejanus stepped into a shared consulship with Tiberius, finally achieving the formal power he had sought for so long, he was undone. Unfortunately for us, the sections of Tacitus's annals that deal with the fall of Sejanus have been lost, so we don't have the same level of detail for this episode that we do for the rest of Tiberius's reign. It seems, though, that Tiberius finally realized just how much Sejanus was usurping his authority after a few letters critical of the prefect made it through Sejanus's screening process. Believing that Sejanus had allied himself with elements of the Julian clan and was planning to overthrow him, Tiberius decided to divest himself of the backstabbing prefect. He called an unsuspecting Sejanus to stand before the Senate to attend to some invented business outlined in a letter from the emperor that was to be read aloud to the assembled senators. To the prefect's shock, amidst the tedium of imperial business, Tiberius's letter suddenly veered into a denunciation of his new consular colleague. Tiberius called for Sejanus to be tried and executed for treason. The Senate, who had suffered mightily under Sejanus's heavy and bloody hand, immediately obliged. Sejanus had no recourse, as Tiberius had already sent notice to the Praetorians that their leader had been replaced, and that Naevius Sutorius Macro was their new prefect. Suddenly, without power or allies, Sejanus was tried, sentenced, and strangled. His death sparked riots in Rome. Suddenly free of the tyrant, they tore his body to pieces and then went off in search of anyone who had collaborated with the fallen prefect in his reign of terror. Among those who were swept up in the immediate aftermath of Sejanus's death was Livilla. A slave with knowledge of her crime waited until he was sure Sejanus was dead and then addressed a letter to Tiberius outlining her involvement in the murder of Drusus. Livilla turned up dead shortly thereafter, and though a definitive account of her death does not exist, the most dramatic account has Tiberius handing Livilla over to her mother Antonia for punishment, whereupon mother locked up daughter and starved her to death. Next week, we will trace the final bloody and debauched years of Tiberius's reign. As so often happens, the purge machine was turned on those who had initiated it, and Tiberius sought to eliminate anyone suspected of ever coming into contact with anyone who had ever considered being a friend of Sejanus. It was a dark time for Rome, and when Tiberius finally died in 37 AD, the people cheered his death. Not only was their hated master dead, but ascending to the throne was the beloved Caligula, son of noble Germanicus. If anyone could put the horrible final years of Tiberius's reign behind them, it was this shining young prince. Yeah, not so much. I will close this week by mentioning around this time, a man claiming to be the son of God was executed in the far-off province of Judea. The crucifixion of the man, Jesus Christ, had absolutely no immediate impact on anything. But in just a few years, after a dramatic, revelatory vision on the road to the Syrian city of Damascus, a man by the name of Saul will turn the execution into one of the most important events in world history. Even simply keeping our focus strictly on Roman history, the emergence and spread of Christianity is a huge development. At first, the early Christians will be ruthlessly persecuted by the Romans, who will find themselves baffled by the Christian unwillingness to treat the emperors as divine. But eventually, Christianity will entrench itself as the official religion of the state, and from there, become the dominant religion of the entire Western world. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 59, To the Tiber with Tiberius. Tiberius had never been particularly happy with his role as emperor. From the beginning of his reign, he had attempted to dump as much of the drudgery of supreme authority as he could off on other people, first trying to enlist a thoroughly disinterested senate, then a willing but dead too soon son, before he finally settled on a supposedly hyper-loyal Praetorian prefect named Lucius Sejanus, who proved to have only his own interests at heart. After the fall of Sejanus, though, Tiberius simply stopped looking for a partner to bear his burdens for him. That is not to say that he actually began to embrace the dull responsibilities of office. Quite the contrary, after Sejanus was executed, Tiberius attended to the empire even less than before. Had it not been for the inertia of the imperial bureaucracy, the empire likely would have devolved into another round of chaotic civil wars the minute ambitious men realized that there was no one manning the helm anymore. But the apparatus Augustus had set up turned out to be self-perpetuating enough to survive 6 years of utter neglect by his successor. In his last years, Tiberius was famously obsessed with two things. One, purging Rome of anything resembling a threat to his power, and two, indulging in his own increasingly inappropriate fetishes. We'll deal with the latter in a moment, but as to the former, in the early 30s BC, Tiberius unleashed a terror on Rome that dwarfed anything perpetuated by Sejanus. I've been thinking a lot about these cycles of violence that have been plaguing Rome for the last century. I mean, I searched for the word purge in the manuscript, and other than a passing reference to Hannibal being a virus that needed to be purged from the Roman body, the word literally does not show up until episode 34, Marius and Sulla. But since then, it is a vocabulary word that I've been turning to with frightening regularity. Marius purges Sulla's supporters. Sulla purges Marius' supporters. The second triumvirate purges the Republicans. The second triumvirate purges each other. Lucius Sejanus purges his political enemies, and now Tiberius is about to purge anyone connected to Sejanus. Julius Caesar was the only one of them who refused to join in the fun, and guess what happened to him? That's right, murdered on the steps of Pompey's theater. There is definitely something to be said for the Romans emerging as the dominant power in the Mediterranean in the mid-100s BC. Annihilating the Carthaginians and conquering the Greeks left the Romans with nothing to keep their politics from turning into life and death struggles. No threat from a foreign other remained to bind the competing political factions to one another. The number of men and women killed in intra-Roman feuds prior to 150 BC is practically nil. The number killed after, too many to count. And here we are again, another round of bloody, violent purges. And believe me, this won't be going away anytime soon. With the state apparatus firmly now in the hands of a single man, if that man turned out to be cruel or paranoid, well, the state simply followed his lead. Tiberius turned out to be cruel and paranoid, and his vehicle for inflicting his wrath on the population of Rome was an escalation of his treason trials. Prescriptions may have been fine for the wild days of yore, but since the beginning of his reign, Tiberius had slowly codified something far more horrific. There is something terrible about being consumed by violent chaos, but I think there is something far more terrifying about being consumed by violent order. After the rise and fall of Sejanus, Tiberius let his perfectly insane, Kafkaesque legal system off its leash and allowed it to consume everyone. Evidence didn't matter, rationality didn't matter. All that mattered was that you had been fingered, or knew someone who had been fingered. I shudder when I think about living under such circumstances. And unfortunately for the people of Rome, there was little they could do about it. As long as the leadership of the Praetorian Guard and the frontier armies were staffed with men loyal to the emperor, there was no fighting back. There was a comment in the thread to last week's episode from listener Mike, wondering where the rest of the legion stood on all of this, and why they didn't push back against the growing power of the Praetorian Guard. The answer is that at the top, the generals appointed to lead the army were men chosen carefully by the emperor, and their loyalty to the regime was their most important qualification for office. Beneath the loyal generals, most of the professional officers in the armies were actually angling themselves for a spot in the Praetorian Guard. They didn't want to push back against the Praetorian Guard's new influence. They wanted to join in the fun. So the civilian population was left at the mercy of the regime. The primary targets of this round of purges were first and foremost families who had connections to Sejanus. The fallen prefect had earned himself many enemies during his rise to power, but he'd also gained many friends as well. With the fall of Sejanus, those friends joined their patron and were themselves accused, tried, and convicted of treason. Some were exiled, others committed suicide, but most, being unable or unwilling to escape the shame of it, were executed. Their property as usual was seized and folded into the imperial treasury. But not content to focus all of his attention on Sejanus partisans, Tiberius also welcomed the opportunity to persecute senatorial and equestrian families with ties to the Julian clan, who he saw as having opposed his regime from the very beginning. Praetorian spies spread themselves throughout the city, and the slightest slip of the tongue, say, complaining at a party, that it sure did stink that your old friend had just committed suicide after being caught up in crazy Tiberius's treason trials, meant that you yourself were about to be caught up in crazy Tiberius's treason trials. Tacitus describes that the trials paid no heed to gender or age. Senior citizens, children, men and women were all hauled before the courts, tried, and executed. Heaps of bodies began to pile up, and it became a crime to even linger where the corpses lay and mourn a dead friend or relative for too long. It also became a crime to attempt to bury or cremate the condemned dead, whose bodies were treated as those of common criminals, left to rot in the streets, or dragged with hooks into the Tiber River. It was a dark time for Rome, and the veil would not be lifted until Tiberius was dead, though we know now that the lifted veil would crash right back down after Caligula arrived and revealed his true colors. While all this was going on, Tiberius remained on Capri, approving lists of victims, but otherwise leaving the empire to its own devices. So what exactly filled the hours of his day? Well, the stories that have come down to us were mostly written after Tiberius's reputation had taken a nosedive, so it's tough to say where fact ends and slander begins. But let's just say that his inhibitions were no longer a factor in his actions. This is a family podcast, and I once upon a time marked the show as clean within the iTunes library, so I would hate to betray that trust by describing in detail what Tiberius was allegedly up to in the last years of his reign, but I will say that just like the treason trials, gender and age did not matter. And also like the treason trials, his victims wound up murdered, supposedly thrown from the cliffs at his villa on Capri when he grew bored with them or was simply not satisfied any longer. The specifics of his alleged depravities can be found in both Suetonius or Tacitus if you would like a full accounting, but just keep in mind that I think a lot of it is probably exaggeration. The final takeaway from the tales of Tiberius's perversions should be that by the time the second emperor of Rome was dead, the people hated and despised him and were eager to utterly trash his reputation. The only silver lining Romans could see in the horror of Tiberius's final years was that the old man would soon be dead, and they would get a chance to start over with a new emperor. It's not like the next man could possibly be as bad as the old bloodthirsty pervert Tiberius. Enter to the stage, please, Gaius Julius Caesar Caligula, the man who would prove that you should never put your trust in the notion that at least it can't get any worse. Because guess what? It can always get worse. Gaius Julius Caesar, the third and youngest son of Germanicus and Agrippina, was born in 12 AD and raised in the legionary camps. It was common practice at the time for a general to take his family with him on assignment. So when Germanicus was put in charge of the legions on the Rhine following the death of Augustus, his wife Agrippina and children, which at this point included 8-year-old Nero, 7-year-old Drusus, and 2-year-old Gaius, went with him. Young Gaius became something of a mascot for the soldiers under Germanicus's command, and the toddler was outfitted with a little army man outfit that he would wear around camp, prompting the soldiers to nickname him Caligula, or Little Boots, after the adorable versions of the sandal boots that the boy would march around in. I should note at this point that while history calls him Caligula, in his time as emperor he was known simply as Gaius. The nickname only came back into use after his death, frequently with ironic derision. When Germanicus was reposted to Syria in 17 AD, the family, now joined by the girls Agrippina the Younger and Drusilla, dutifully followed along, and when Germanicus died 2 years later, the children, including now the infant Julia Livilla, returned to Rome with Agrippina. The next decade would be difficult for Agrippina and her children. Deathly afraid that any man who married Germanicus's widow would immediately become a powerful rival, Tiberius forbade Agrippina to remarry. This left the family adrift with no other paterfamilias than Tiberius himself, who hated and feared the whole lot of them. Caligula managed to stay below Tiberius's radar when the paranoid old man decided he couldn't stand the family any longer and prosecuted for treason Agrippina and the 2 elder boys, Nero and Drusus. With their mother and elder brothers dead, the remaining children were shunted off to live with their grandmother Antonia, who looked after them for the next few years. The girls were one by one married off at Tiberius's orders, while Caligula remained in a sort of limbo. After the fall of Sejanus, though, Tiberius gave enough passing thought to a successor that he called for Caligula to come live with him on Capri. The young future emperor seems to have managed to avoid crossing Tiberius during the 6 years he spent as a virtual prisoner on the island by repressing all the fear and resentment he likely felt towards the old man and pretended to be nothing less than the pliant servant of the aging emperor. In 33 AD, Caligula was given an honorary quaestorship, the only official office he would hold before becoming the supreme ruler of the empire. And also in that year, he married Junia Claudilla, though the union would only survive until Junia's death in childbirth a year later. In 35 AD, Tiberius changed his will to take some account for succession, ordering that his estate, and thus the throne, jointly fall to Caligula and Tiberius's grandson, Tiberius Gemellus, the only surviving son of the ill-fated marriage between Drusus and Livilla. Unlike Augustus, who had obsessed over succession and spent a great deal of his energy readying his potential successors, first Marcellus, then Tiberius and Drusus, then Gaius and Lucius, Tiberius seems to have done nothing to prepare Caligula or Gemellus for imperial responsibility. Gemellus, at this point, was barely even a teenager. In 37 AD, death finally came knocking for Tiberius, though the details of his final moments are the source of some debate. Some sources claim that the now 77-year-old emperor who had ruled Rome for 23 years simply passed away in his sleep. Another, more colorful account is that the emperor was reported to have finally succumbed to a fatal illness, which prompted the people of Rome to begin celebrating his death. But then another report followed right on the heels of the first, stating that the emperor had actually recovered. Then a third and final report came, stating that the emperor's recovery was a fiction and that he had in fact died. This last report was issued by the Praetorian prefect Naevius Sutorius Macro, who had gone in to confirm for himself the death of the emperor. And by confirm the death of the emperor himself, I of course mean smother with a pillow the weak but fully recovered Tiberius. A third version of the story points to Caligula as the murderer, but since this version was recounted by Caligula himself in an attempt to be seen as the man who finally delivered Rome from his wicked grandfather, I think we can safely dismiss this version. Caligula was also fond of telling people that he used to creep into Tiberius's room at night and stand over the sleeping emperor with a brandished knife, and would refrain from doing what he felt was right, namely murdering the evil Tiberius, only at the behest of the divine Augustus, whose voice commanded him to be patient and let nature take its course. Yeah, Caligula was nuts. However it happened, Tiberius was dead, and the people rejoiced. Such was the depth of their hatred for him that rather than calling for elaborate funeral arrangements, they simply cried out, to the Tiber with Tiberius. They wanted to do to him what he had done to them, and treat his body as nothing more than a corpse of a criminal, drag it through the streets of Rome on hooks, and then deposit it unceremoniously into the river. The people did not get their way, though, and a formal funeral and cremation were arranged. But Tiberius was conspicuously not granted the same divine honors the Senate had tripped over itself bestowing upon Augustus. Though Tiberius's will specified that Caligula and Gemellus should jointly rule the empire, Caligula had no interest in sharing power. The shrinking violet mask he had worn for years to avoid Tiberius's wrath was now cast aside. Having likely arranged in advance with Macro that when the day came, the Praetorian prefect would figure prominently in the new regime if the guard declared for Caligula and Caligula alone, Gemellus was immediately locked out of his inheritance when Tiberius died. The young man turned out to be one of the first victims of Caligula's reign, and did not survive the year. First, he was denied his inheritance. Then, he was put under something resembling house arrest. Then, he was executed for allegedly conspiring against the new regime. The boy's unhappy destiny, it seems, was to live as a prisoner of two emperors before finally being murdered at the tender age of 18, guilty of nothing more than being born into the wrong family at the wrong time. After freezing out Gemellus, Caligula made preparations to give the people of Rome something they had not seen in more than a decade, a personal appearance by their emperor. The imperial house, he announced, was returning from exile. The people were ecstatic at the news, and when Caligula arrived, they lined the roads out to the 20th milepost to greet him. When they saw the new emperor, they shouted at him every pet name they could think of, calling him our prince and our star, and of course, Little Boots. With the handsome 24-year-old son of Germanicus ascending to the throne, it seemed like things were about to change for the better, that it might go back to the way that it had been under Augustus. It was reported that over 150,000 animal sacrifices were made across the empire to celebrate the good news. And at first, Caligula's ascension really was good news. He immediately canceled the treason trials and made a very public show of gathering all the records and evidence that had been gathered by Tiberius's spies and burning it all in a great public bonfire. Those who had managed to survive by going into exile were recalled to Rome and pardoned of whatever crime they had been charged with or convicted of. Suetonius even recounts an episode where Caligula went so far as to refuse to even read a report supposedly outlining a plot against him. To explain his decision, the emperor simply said that since no one had any reason to hate him, he didn't have time to read such idle memoranda. And at this point, he was probably more right about that than wrong. The people of Rome no longer feared daily for their lives and property thanks to Caligula. It's hard to hate a guy for making you feel safe in your own home again. Caligula then went further. He canceled an unpopular tax the Italians had been chafing under, while simultaneously upping the pay for soldiers on the frontier and in the Praetorian Guard. He also reinstated a few of the provisional client monarchs who had been deposed by Tiberius for spurious reasons, and not only gave them their power back, but promised them the tax receipts they would have received had they not been removed from power. To top off his generous arrival to the throne, Caligula initiated lavish gladiatorial games to celebrate the dawning of this new day. At all levels of the empire, from the common citizens to the middle-class merchants to the rich aristocracy to the soldiers in the field and the provincials they defended, Emperor Caligula was a godsend. The pious young emperor then gathered up the bones of his dead mother and brothers and brought them back to Rome for burial in the imperial mausoleum. And finally, he renamed the month of September for his dear departed father Germanicus. Yep, everything was going A-OK. So the question is, what happened? Well, apparently behind the happy facade, all was not well in the house of Caesar. Caligula had never been given the training he needed to really be an effective ruler. He had no experience in administration, had not served in the legions, and had been given no real responsibilities of his own until the moment he became emperor. His early political success seems to have been built largely by his doing nothing more than give the people whatever they wanted. Lower taxes? Sure. More benefits? Sure. Higher pay for the army? Of course. Lavish games and free grain for the mobs? I wouldn't think of doing anything less. It was a completely unsustainable combination of policies, of course, but it seems that the only thing Caligula learned at Tiberius's knee during their 6 years together was that being emperor meant doing what you wanted, when you wanted, with whomever you wanted. Nothing about maintaining steady revenue streams or limiting expenditures to justifiable ends or striking a balance between needs and wants. Caligula basically just said yes to anything and everything, no matter how contradictory all those things turned out to be. With this public policy time bomb ticking in the background, Caligula followed in Tiberius's footsteps and began indulging excessively in wine, women, food, and games. The hard living may have caught up with him, because in October of 37, just 6 months after rising to power, Caligula was struck down by a serious illness and nearly died. The people were distraught at the news, and prayers and promises of every shape and form were sent up to the gods to beg them for the safe return of their new emperor. Famously, a few senators promised to trade their own lives for Caligula's if only the emperor recovered. Basically, these were the same empty promises that are often made on deathbeds. Oh, Jupiter, take me instead, that sort of thing. But then, Caligula recovered. Now, a few of the ancient sources don't draw a one-to-one causal link between the illness and the subsequent madness of Caligula's reign, but a few do point to the event as the decisive turning point. And certainly, if you were to ask the senators who had pledged their lives in a moment of melodramatic piety, they would tell you that the Caligula who went in was not the same as the Caligula who came out. Because when the emperor recovered and learned of their generous offers, he supposedly took them at their word. How nice that you pledged your life so that I may live. I'm just wondering then, what are you still doing here? Shouldn't you be at home committing suicide? After all, what will the gods do if you break your oath? Pale-faced and in shock, the unfortunate senators in question had little recourse but to follow through on their once empty promise. In I, Claudius, Caligula's recovery from his illness is portrayed as the catalyst for his delusions of godhood, but the scattered accounts we have of his reign don't show him moving decisively towards self-deification until a few years later. So though the illness is a convenient place to point to and say, before this line, good, after this line, bad, it is probably more complicated than that. I, however, will take it as a convenient place to stop this week's episode. Next week, we'll get into the guts of Caligula's short and brutal reign. Though he was emperor for just 4 years, that proved time enough to mark him as one of, if not the, most infamous ruler in Roman history. Incest, murder, rape, and theft are all the calling cards of Caligula, and next week, we'll do our best to separate myth from fact. I mean, did this psycho really try to have his horse named Consul? Before we go this week, though, I'm going to take another personal moment, as today is Father's Day here in the United States. Dad, wherever and whenever you get this episode, happy Father's Day. I love you too. Though I plan to show you zero mercy in this week's Grandpa D. Herm's epic battle for second place in the Western Amateur T-Ball League. Welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 60, No Better Slave, No Worse Master. The honeymoon lasted for about 6 months. The brief window of optimism that opened with the death of Tiberius was slammed shut by Caligula before the year was out. The half year between Tiberius's death and Caligula's nearly fatal illness can be described as the period after which the Romans had jumped from the frying pan, but before they hit the fire. Because as it turns out, that while Tiberius was cruel, paranoid, and calculating, Caligula was simply mad as a hatter. Now I think most of us, even those who are relatively new to Roman history, know that Caligula was up to some pretty rotten stuff. Even people I know who have no interest in history whatsoever generally know, for example, that a pretty disturbing flick called Caligula came out once upon a time, and that the guy had to be pretty messed up for the movie based on his life to gin up so much controversy. Which is true. Incoherent as it is, Caligula the movie does do a pretty good job capturing the essence of the man as portrayed by the ancient historians. But the question is then, how accurate were those ancient historians? Should we really believe every detail that has been handed down to us as objective truth, or should we take some of it with a grain of salt? Unfortunately, we've lost the relevant chapters from Tacitus, who is generally the most reliable source for information on the early imperial period, and we're left with a combination of Suetonius and Cassius Dio, both of whom were writing well after the fact, and the contemporary passing accounts of Philo of Alexandria and Seneca, both of whom had their own individual bones to pick with the mad emperor. In his Sex in the Ancient World, John J. Younger points out that Romans would often use tales of sexual deviancy to emphasize how bad a public official was, the way that we might say that some despised ruler regularly kicks puppies or refuses to call his mother on her birthday. So with everyone agreeing that Caligula had psychological issues and that he was a train wreck of an emperor, it is not surprising that his biography has become packed with deviant sexual activity. The same basic dynamic, by the way, is at play with biographies of Tiberius, and will be at play again when we get to Nero and his alleged Oedipal relationship with his mother Agrippina. So I'm sure that there is a lot that the ancient historians got right about Caligula, but much of it is undoubtedly exaggeration. When Caligula recovered from his illness in late 37, his personality either changed dramatically or, more likely, who he was simply began to break through the magnificent glow the people had shrouded him in. In the wake of Tiberius, the Romans were quick to project their own needs onto this savior, Caligula. So I think it's quite likely that he was the same man throughout. It's just that nobody was really ready to notice what a crazy cretin he was until the initial honeymoon period was over. I mean, he had been dealt blow after traumatic blow his entire life, and had spent years thoroughly repressed, sucking up to the man who had killed his father, his mother, and his two brothers. So I don't think that Caligula needed anything so dramatic as a near-death experience to go off the deep end. Imperial slaves, who spent more time around the boy than anyone, certainly would have agreed that Caligula needed no illness to become unhinged. Watching him alternate between the pliant and passive servant of Tiberius and the sadistic teenager who relaxed by witnessing the beatings and executions that occurred regularly at the imperial villa on Capri, the slaves reported that concerning Gaius, there was no better slave and no worse master. Now that he was emperor, he was the slave to no man, and it was all no worse master from here on out. So let's jump on into the Funhouse of Horrors, shall we? We should probably get the most famous rumor about Caligula out of the way early, and that is that he was engaged in incestual relationships with his sisters, Julia Livilla, Agrippina, and particularly his favorite, Drusilla. The charges, like I say, likely spring from the fact that later unhappiness with Caligula led to some serious character assassination. But it's worth noting that the perception of incest was not made up out of whole cloth. It is understandable that Caligula and his sisters, suffering as orphans together, would be closer than your average set of siblings, but Caligula appears to have taken things to an extreme. The emperor, for example, seems to have had an atypical married life. He was married four times in his short life, with his first wife dying in childbirth, and his second and third wives coming and going within a matter of months. The constant matrons of Caligula's house then in the early part of his reign were not his wives, but rather his sisters, particularly, like I say, Drusilla. His relationship with Drusilla was so close, in fact, that during his bachelor periods between wives, Caligula eschewed the custom of rotating hostesses for his dinner parties, instead sticking exclusively with Drusilla, in effect saying that she is my wife. However, there is no solid evidence of sexual activity between the two, and coupled with his more general embrace of living godhood, it looks like he may have just been playing out the kind of sister-brother-husband-wife dynamic seen in many Eastern religions. But the very public role Drusilla took on as Caligula's primary female companion makes it a not particularly hard leap to believe that maybe something was going on behind closed doors. Not long before her death, which we'll get to in a moment, Caligula further demanded that she be included in the oaths taken by legionary soldiers when swearing to protect the emperor, again, in effect saying that she was to be considered his wife. So while the incest rap may be a bad one, Caligula basically did everything in his power to make it hard for people to believe otherwise. That all being said, the incest charges only dominated the gossip of the early part of Caligula's reign, because in mid-38, Drusilla came down with a fever and died. The grief-stricken Caligula, who did not leave Drusilla's side during the illness, ordered that the entire empire go into mourning upon her death, and thereafter would often swear oaths to the divine Drusilla. whom he inducted into the growing imperial pantheon. Unfortunately for Rome, though, once she was gone, the gloves really came off. For the 3 years left on his reign, Roman historians describe at length a man who personifies everything that is awful about absolute power resting in the hands of a single man. Unlike Augustus and Tiberius, who tried to downplay their power and defer to the Senate as much as possible, Caligula had no interest in such things, and actually went out of his way to do everything he could to demean the Senate and exalt himself above them. For example, he would force them to run alongside his carriage while it made its way through Rome, and any senator who failed to show up or display the proper amount of enthusiasm were noted by the emperor and then targeted for future humiliations. One of his reported favorite pastimes was to bring senators and their wives to dinner, and over the course of the meal, pick out one of the married women and disappear with her to the bedroom while her shamed husband was forced to remain at the table. Caligula would then return with the wife in question and proceed to describe in detail everything that had gone on in the bedroom. There was no recourse for the distressed couple. Any challenge to Caligula's whims was fast becoming a capital offense. Both Caligula's second and third marriages were actually the result of stealing women from their husbands, and in the case of his second wife, Livia Orestilla, it was actually on the occasion of her marriage that the theft went down. Invited to the wedding, Caligula took a shine to the bride and told the new husband, Gaius Calpurnius Piso, who will feature prominently in the episode on Nero, to, quote, get away from my wife, and then immediately absconded with the poor woman. Caligula would abandon her just days later, but not before twisting the knife further and forbidding her to remarry Piso. Why did he do it? Who knows? Men and women now lived in perpetual fear that they would say the wrong thing, or do the wrong thing, or do the right thing, but at the wrong time. One young aristocrat was forced to fight as a gladiator simply because he was good-looking and made Caligula jealous. After the man won both of his matches, Caligula had him hauled off in chains and executed. Good times. But the biggest fear was that Caligula would simply covet your estate and confiscate it all after arresting and killing you for no reason. In this, he was indiscriminate. He didn't even bother working up any kind of paranoid fantasy to explain who he was targeting. He would just send agents to your doors one day, and you would be hauled off to court, tried, and exiled or killed. The executions themselves became a hallmark of Caligula's sadism, as he would force parents to come witness the executions of their children. When one man said that he was too sick to attend, Caligula sent around one of his imperial carriages to pick the man up and make sure that he could be there. And when the condemned were killed, they were not simply strangled or hurled from the Tarpeian Rock. No, Caligula was famous for promoting the maxim of death by a thousand cuts. Major organs were left alone as the victims were nicked and bled and stabbed over the course of sometimes days. His usual order to the executioners was to make him feel that he is dying. When one man continued to proclaim his innocence as the execution began, Caligula halted the proceedings. Then he ordered the soldiers to cut out the man's tongue so Caligula would be able to enjoy the execution in peace. Charming stuff. The only practical foundation for all of this random cruelty was that Caligula needed money, lots and lots of money. Tiberius had been, famously, a spendthrift, who in his later life basically vetoed every spending bill he ever saw. He probably took it too far, leaving many worthy projects unfunded, but there is no denying that when he died, the empire was in excellent financial shape. The treasury was well-stocked, and revenue was outpacing expenditures. Caligula managed to blow up this financial cushion within 2 years of taking office, leaving the empire and the imperial family massively in debt. Some things he did were decent enough. He finished the Temple of Augustus and built improved ports at Rhegium and on Sicily to facilitate more grain shipments. He also expanded the aqueduct system that was essential for bringing clean water into the city. But mostly, he just blew through the treasury, building huge personal yachts, lavish villas, and a personal chariot racetrack. Caligula's basic motto was, why pay retail when you can pay 10 times retail? At one point, he called for hundreds of ships to line up beside one another in the Gulf of Baiae. Then, he packed them with earth and mortar, turning the whole line into a bridge between the resort at Baiae and the port of Puteoli on the other side of the Gulf. He then rode his horse across the two-mile expanse. Legend has it that the entire operation was undertaken because Tiberius's astrologer had once remarked that Caligula had no more hope of becoming empire than he did crossing the Gulf of Baiae on horseback. It would make for an almost light-hearted tale, except for the massive expenditures involved and the fact that by pressing all the ships into becoming a bridge, Rome suffered from a grain shortage due to the lack of available freighters. By 39, Caligula's relationship with the Senate and people was shot. The man they had once hailed as their savior had proved himself to be nothing more than an erratic sadist who was bankrupting the empire. Caligula had showed the Senate nothing but disrespect, going so far as to promise to have his favorite horse named Consul because it possessed more intelligence than the whole lot of them put together. Eventually, the senators began to mumble under their breath that we really need to do something to rein this psychopath in. Catching wind that some kind of resistance movement was being organized, Caligula called the Senate to meet and revealed to them a big surprise. He had made copies of all the treason trial notes that he had allegedly destroyed upon taking office. Suddenly, the treason trials were back up and running. The Senate was forced to accept the emperor's decision, but unlike with the 70-year-old Tiberius, they could not reasonably hope to outlast the emperor. Caligula was still in his late 20s, so the madness could go on for 50 years or more. So it is probably at this point that Caligula's death warrant was really signed. He left them no choice but to eventually assassinate him. The simple logic of survival demanded it. It was right around this time, too, that Caligula began to let it be known that he was actually more than just a man. Unlike Augustus and Tiberius, who made no claims of divinity while they were alive, Augustus, in fact, went to great lengths to stop people from worshiping him as a god, Caligula decided that everyone was free to worship him as divine if they wished. In fact, he insisted. He began appearing in public dressed as Hercules and Apollo and Mercury, sometimes even Venus. More and more, he began to talk as if he were in fact a god, trapped down here on earth with all these scummy mortals who forever got in his way. The people more or less humored these claims because, hey, what else are you going to do? So when Caligula ordered that his statue be placed in every temple in the empire for worship, most everyone obliged. But his extreme megalomania ran into a brick wall in the far eastern province of Judea. When imperial agents brought word that a statue of the emperor was to be erected in the holy Jewish temple in Jerusalem, there were nearly riots. The fiercely monotheistic Jews, who were already pretty angry that they were forced to live under the Roman yoke to begin with, had no intention of allowing some egotistical punk to share the stage with Yahweh. It was only the timely intervention of Herod Agrippa that prevented a massive uprising against the Romans. Herod was the grandson of Herod the Great, and as a child, he had been sent to live in Rome and was befriended by the imperial family. When Caligula became emperor, Herod had been sent home to govern the eastern territories, and it was only because of his personal influence that he had with Caligula that he was able to first delay the idea of erecting the statue and then get the idea killed altogether. Had Herod not been there to talk some sense into Caligula, the revolt in Judea almost certainly would have erupted 30 years earlier than it eventually did. Having become a god, though, there was still something conspicuously absent from Caligula's resume. Military conquest. Being an imperator without any military triumphs to point to is like being a surgeon who has never performed surgery. It just doesn't make sense on the face of it. So to rectify the situation, he got it in his head that he should return to the site of his father's glory and finally bring Germania to heel. Completely lacking in skill, experience, and training, though, the campaign was probably never going to end well, so it was probably a good thing that it wound up ending early. He did lead the legions across the Rhine, but was nervous about penetrating too far into the forests. Not really craving an actual battle, he sent some allied Gauls into the woods dressed as Germans so that he could pretend to charge heroically into their midst when they emerged from the woods at the appointed hour. After this staged episode, he strutted about camp, bragging about his own bravery in contrast to the rest of the men who had milled around when word of the attack came. Then reports arrived that there were really real Germans in the area, at which point Caligula's entourage ran everyone over, getting the emperor back to the Roman side of the Rhine. The whole thing is just cartoonishly pathetic. But while he was out playing soldier, a conspiracy involving a local Roman governor was uncovered that seems to have put the kibosh on the rest of the campaign. The details are unknown, but it was a serious enough plot that his brother-in-law was executed, and his two remaining sisters, Agrippina and Julia Lavilla, wound up exiled, suggesting Caligula had been hit fairly close to home. Having accomplished nothing in Germania, Caligula did what any sensible politician would do to save face. He declared victory and left. In 40 AD, the emperor turned his attention to Britannia, that foggy island on the edge of the world. But again, he managed to do little more there than add another bizarre chapter to his already bizarre biography. According to legend, he lined up the legions in battle formation along the banks of the English Channel, even though there was no enemy there to fight. The men waited around expectantly until Caligula's orders finally came down. Go forth and collect all the seashells on the beach and bring them back to Italy as spoils of this great victory over Neptune and the sea. Uh-huh. Having won another, battle, Caligula returned to Rome and celebrated a dual triumph in honor of his successful campaigns in Germania and Britain. The collected seashells were dutifully displayed as prized treasure. Can someone, anyone, do us all a favor and just knife this guy? Back home, Caligula settled into happy domesticity with his new wife and child. In either 39 or 40, he had begun an affair with a woman named Caesonia that resulted in the birth of a daughter, Julia Drusilla, named for Caligula's late lamented sister. In Caesonia, Caligula finally found a kindred spirit, who he was not related to. Though she was much older than he was, she relished in extravagance, opulence, and had no empathy for anyone whatsoever. She was, in short, a perfect match for the mad emperor. They seemed to be perfectly happy with one another, though Caligula would often remind her in a doting sort of way that he could slit her throat whenever he wanted. But the good times were not to last. Caligula may have thought that he was a god, and that he could do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted, to whomever he wanted, but that did not mean that people were going to like it. It was only a matter of time before what went around came around, and in early 41 AD, it came back around. There was a member of the Praetorian Guard by the name of Cassius Caria who had had enough. Caligula would often single the man out and mock him for his effeminacy and allude to a genitalia-related injury Caria had suffered while on campaign. After being humiliated time and time again, the angry Praetorian Guardsman began to whisper with members of the Senate who were looking for any opportunity to off this psychotic brat of an emperor. Caria agreed to be the man on the inside and brought two others in as formal accomplices. The plot was hatched with the tacit approval of the Praetorian prefect, who was himself under investigation for treason and thus needed to get rid of Caligula before Caligula got rid of him. In January of 41 AD, after Caligula was done addressing a troupe of actors for an upcoming theatrical performance, Caria and the two accomplices cornered the emperor and stabbed him to death. Caligula was 28 years old and had ruled Rome for just shy of 4 years. The assassins then quickly made their way to the imperial family's chambers and killed Caesonia and the infant Drusilla. There could be no blood heir to Caligula left alive. With the emperor dead, the big question was, what came next? Caria himself seems to have been under the impression that by killing the emperor, it might give the Senate a chance to step into the power vacuum and return Rome to its republican roots. But that was, of course, a pipe dream. The Praetorian Guard as a whole did not share their comrades' idealism. As it turned out, Caria and the other assassins were unable to get to Uncle Claudius before the rest of the guard hustled the stammering fool into the safety of their camp. According to legend, Claudius was hiding behind a curtain when they found him, but that is most likely a later dramatic flourish. That very night, the guard declared Claudius to be the new emperor, which, when word got out, seemed like some kind of sick joke. Everyone knew that Claudius was a mushy-headed dunce who had managed to stay alive through the reigns of Tiberius and Caligula because he made such a great butt for jokes. There was no way that he was capable of ruling the empire. And this was, of course, precisely the point. the Praetorian leadership figured Claudius would be easy to control. As we'll see next week, though, Claudius seems to have had everyone fooled pretty well. He was no fool at all, and would prove to be a thoroughly competent emperor, even if his domestic life left something to be desired. The short and brutal reign of Caligula is an object lesson for why you don't put absolute power in the hands of one man, especially without vetting him first. Though he was the first really terrible emperor, he will certainly not be the last, as every generation or so, another Caligula will emerge to remind everyone why they tried to get away from all of this in the first place, why they had shared consulships, why they had thrown the kings out, why they had set up the Senate, why they had set up the people's assemblies, why it was just dumb to give absolute power to just one guy. But it was too late to go back to the days of a shared consulship or the diffusion of power. All the Romans could do now was try to survive the bad years and hope that the next guy would be better. Because, like it or not, the emperors had all the power now.